Welcome to Focus on Art, our new series and podcast delving into the arts with your hosts, John McCormick, Sarita Patel, and Latham Woodward. Each week, we're bringing compelling stories and guests to talk about the arts in general. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode. This week, we're privileged to have John McCormick in studio. I recently did a piece on John in our other video podcast called Focus on the Artist John McCormick. And John received a lot of comments, but he had some comments too after the episode. So he asked to come on and talk about art and the life of a professional artist. So John, welcome to the studio.
Oh, thank you.
And Sarita, as always, good to see you.
Hi, Latham. Nice to see you, too.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be back online and on air with you both. And, John, so you did have some comments to me last week, and I said, let's just do this, because you were afraid that I was going to react to criticism in a negative way. I personally feel that criticism is essential. And, you know, if you're not getting critique, you're not improving yourself. So I really wanted to hear what you had. It was my comments mainly about the cafe lifestyle, I remember that.
Yes, of course.
But, you know, I don't, I'm not a professional artist, right? I mean, right. I do this, and I guess this is an art in itself. But, you know, what was your takeaway from our comments in our last episode and the importance of art in all of our lives?
Well, okay, to begin, you know, the title, The Importance of Art in All of Our Lives, is near and dear to me because, you know, as I said in the video, I've been involved with the arts more than half my life now, and over 40 years professionally. And I wanted to, when I critiqued you, I wanted to dispel a few of the kind of stereotypes about artists that they lived the cafe lifestyle was one that you just mentioned. That may be good for some artists, but most of the artists that I've known who are, they're hardworking people, and they get so into their work at times that they, you know, they get outside of that kind of time space continuum, and they're literally not eating. I mean, they're just working through dinner time or, you know, lunch or end dinner, and they're very hardworking people, and those are the people that, in my experience, again, have actually, you know, met with some level of success in their art, with their art, whether it's, you know, painting or music or being a writer or any of the arts. And you know, because there's that kind of, you know, as I said earlier, this stereotype of the artist being like Maynard G. Krebs, you know, afraid of work or some kind of, you know, other kind of thing. And I just wanted to kind of deal with that first and foremost. And then I'd like to talk today with Sarita about how the arts can, you know, cultivate well-being in all of us, whether we're artists or not. And I think it's so important, especially in these times, in this culture where the demands of, you know, are pretty stringent on the average person to, you know, make a living and take care of their family and all those sort of things. And how, even if you're, like I said, not an artist, you can engage in the arts and plug in somewhere, and it will, I think, enhance your well-being and make your life better.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but you just opened up a huge can of worms with Sarita.
She's, oh, yeah.
She has lived a life amongst artists for many, many years. And she certainly knows the difference between the casual artist and the real artist, so right, to speak, right? Go ahead, Sarita.
Well, one of the things that you just said, and I think you wanted to clarify, and which is that you do work hard, and that you often don't eat, and you know the life of an artist just to survive, it can be depressing, suicidal for some. Not, you know, maybe you, but you, because you're a professional. But just even think about bank notes they are a work of art mm-hmm. all over the world. So why would, you know, the like, I mean, I could go off on so many tangents, but I want to not forget how beautiful banknotes are and that an artist made all of those notes and they are highly sophisticated. They are not random and put together like a marketing logo can be.
No, no. I would agree. I mean, there. I was just looking at some artwork by the famous New York artist Larry Rivers, and he did a series of paintings and drawings on French money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how beautiful it was. You know, it had pictures of Napoleon yeah. on there. And you know, of course, he you know, did certain abbreviations and modifications to fit his style of painting. But that was the vehicle to get started on that particular, you know, line of work.
Yeah, that was but, Gautier, I believe was his name, who was the artist who did Liberté. And yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Originally. Yeah, okay. But, yeah, I mean, you know, just to be clear, you don't have to be an artist in the, you know, true sense of the world, word, a creative, so to speak, to live an artistic lifestyle. I mean, I was riding a bus across from San Francisco to Emeryville, and the bus driver, in a rather mundane job, made it a lot of fun by being creative, talking to the people. He was talking like he was a tour guide. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was very entertaining, and it made the bus ride, which was really only about a half hour, a little more entertaining. But you can be creative in any part of your life. And with regard to artists being, the, you know, suicidal, or I mean, I've known criminal attorneys who are suicidal. I mean, that can hit any mm-hmm. profession. And I think, you know, a part of what we're talking about here today is, well, okay, if you are having ups and downs in whatever career you are, how can the arts take you to a better place?
Yeah.
I mean, the simplest thing is open a book of nice paintings and look at it for 15 minutes or go to a beautiful museum show. And we have some great museums here in the Bay Area. You know, if you want to move beyond that kind of engagement, you can do something, you know, do some writing.
Mm-hmm.
15 minutes of writing in the morning can really set the tone for your day, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's just, you know, and these are just simple solutions and often overlooked that can make your whole life better. And I brought this book along. It's called Your Brain on Art by Susan Magsimon and Ivy Ross. And there are a couple of neuroscientists who did a wonderful book. I encourage your listeners to pick up a copy. And it talks about...
What was it called again?
It's called Your Brain on Art. And the subtitle is How the Arts Transform Us.
Perfect.
And it's kind of been an area that I've been interested in because this is really recent information, really this idea of neuroscience. So the idea of how the neuroscience of our brains is actually altered by engagement in the arts is a very recent study. It started primarily in the 1980s, so it's only been around a little over 40 years. And, you know, with modern technology, MRI and things like that, I mean, they've literally placed people in MRI situations and read them poetry and watched how certain brain activity happens. Oxytocin is increased, serotonin, dopamine levels go up. And when people dance, simple thing like dancing, so good for you, mm-hmm. for your sense of well-being. And again, I'm going to make the point over and over today that these are all simple solutions and available to all of us to help us center ourselves and become you know, enjoy our lives more, you mm-hmm. know, and hopefully live longer, you know, mm-hmm. because of it.
Yeah, I wanted to interject too, for those of you in the audience who haven't detected already, John was a teacher.
Yeah, there's that part for sure.
Well, yeah. And it's such an important conversation that we're having right now, and it's why Latham and I wanted to, you know, do a series on art, mm-hmm. not just to talk about art as an object for sale.
Yeah.
But, you know, I come from a family of four girls, and I would say that two of them were categorized as artists, mm-hmm. and the other ones weren't. Me and I was included in the not artistic, because I thought it was something that you had to work at. But having two sisters who were just born naturally needing to express themselves in that way really opened up my whole life. I mean, it is a direct contributor to why I feel like I was successful in my journey, because it was like an open palette all the time. I never really looked at my life as go do this and then you'll get this and you'll do this. It was sort of like a palette that you could paint.
Mm-hmm.
And so in talking about art and neuroscience, which I think is incredibly important right now to have that correlation identified, is we are in transformative times right now.
Oh, yeah.
And there is really the creative mind, the idea of knowing that you can express yourself and not have it directly connected to a paycheck, maybe, for lack of a better word,
yeah.
could actually allow us to turn this titanic of a situation that we're in a couple notches.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I mean, you know, you look at somebody like Steve Jobs. I see him, he was an artist, mm-hmm. first and foremost. I mean, even after he had, you know, become very successful, and his whole drive still was, he never forgot that art centered him and was the catalyst for so many of his ideas. For instance, he was very interested in haiku, pottery, and so mm-hmm. forth. And he traveled, I heard this documentary on somewhere, might have been YouTube or one of those. And he traveled to, China or Japan, one or the other. And he got way out in the boonies, you know, and because he had heard of certain you know, ceramicists who were legendary, you know, and they were far from commercial, but they had influenced whole schools of pottery. And he found some of these guys, and they actually did an interview with one of these legendary ceramic artists. And they said when he came in, you know, he's very quiet, and Steve Jobs, and he was. And when they placed a piece of pottery on the table, he got down and he was looking at it and really studying it. And of course, he bought a few pieces, and apparently, you know, they were at a premium price. You mm-hmm. know, even those people were way out there, and they weren't, you know, trying to be in the marketplace with their work. But you know, it was kind of like build it and they will come. Mm-hmm. People were coming to them from all over, and apparently. The design of one of these pieces of pottery was the genesis of the smartphone, the simplicity and the elegance of the smartphone. So, you know, the art and the inspiration came before the actual commercial success, so mm-hmm. to speak. So, you know, I guess my deep and bigger point in all of that was that I think if you can find a place to prioritize art in your life in some form, it will lead and help you in your other pursuits. You know, we all need to make money. There's, mm-hmm. there's nothing glamorous about poverty, you know, mm-hmm. and so often, it's hard for artists because, you know, they're doing these things and they're not getting recognition and, you know, they become maybe somewhat disillusioned and so forth. What I've often seen with actual artists who are, is that it's not so much that their work isn't good, it's their business sense is lacking. Mm-hmm. And they don't know how to maybe make that adjustment and then balance between doing the art and then somehow getting some level of getting it in the marketplace.
John, wait, can I ask John a question? Because yeah. I think yeah. what you brought up was just really cogent in terms of like the interpretation of art in people's lives.
Right.
But on the artist side, there's a lot of artists out there who do really weird stuff, like different. Mm-hmm. It's maybe not for me and maybe not for you, but there are people who like that stuff.
Right.
And that's the weird thing. It's about finding your connection, because so-called fine art, like this one here on the wall, you can't see it, you're in, you're listening, but it's waves on the ocean coast, and it's beautiful, it's expensive, it's wonderful. To most people, that's art. But stick figures playing tennis to somebody is art.
Sure.
Right? Mm-hmm. So it's the artist could be frustrated, but they probably have not found their special connection yet. Because you never know, especially in the day and age of the virality of posts and videos and things like this. There's someone for your audience always, it seems like.
Or the, yeah,
you just have to find the audience.
Can I make
a point? Mm-hmm. I don't think the idea of trying to find an audience should be the starting point of doing
that's not what I meant. Yeah. I'm just saying that there's frustration level of an artist not finding their audience, but they're not searching for that audience. The audience has not found them yet.
I would say for the artist, it's important to find your voice, you know, whether it's music, writing, you know, find that thing. I mean, you know, Mario Puzo wrote many, many books before The Godfather.
Yes.
And they were critically acclaimed and, you know, just brilliant. And I'm not sure what the subject matter was, but I did hear an interview with him. And he finally got so frustrated because he wasn't getting any kind of recognition. And so he wrote this book about gangsters called The Godfather. And his whole life changed.
The rest is history.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, he kind of did that as kind of a one-off. And then, but you know, everything that he did before led up to that. So, I mean, you know, there's this kind of like, you know, everything's cumulative. So if you're an artist out there and you're hearing this, know that everything's building towards something. And if you don't, you know, give up, sooner or later, you know, you will find your voice. Yeah. And in that, there's a lot of satisfaction, you know, even if you have to work a day job for the rest of your life or do something completely different, knowing that you found that thing that's unique to you and you feel really good. And every time you get there in that zone with it, that creative zone, and it just lifts you.
Yeah.
Well, that's a human technology.
Yes.
You know, the act of making art.
Yes.
And so what you're basically saying is what, you know, our company, Madmana, is basically how do you support the creatives and the entrepreneurs in getting their idea across the finish line? And I, based on what you just said about, you know, oftentimes artists don't know how to apply the business arena into monetizing their craft. That's why we started Madmana. We wanted to help with that.
Good.
But even going back to the human technology, it is building up. It's like you don't, the mistake people make with their children, for example, trying to get them to walk faster than the crawling stage.
Right.
There's so much that you miss if you speed that up.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah. 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 You just have to, you know, I mean, find the pace that's best for you to work at, and don't listen to anybody else. And that's hard to do.
You know? I'm going to agree with you on that one. And John Crane, our good friend John Crane, who's a great writer, he told us that too when I was doing some videos for people. It's like, don't let any other people into your creative space.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It does not work. You compromise yourself.
And that's why I said in the video that all artists in the end are self-taught, because, agreed. I mean, you go to college. I mean, the reason I went to college is, you know, was more for the art history and to, you know, get an understanding of where being an artist might personally fit into this broad history of art, you know, starting all the way back with the Greeks, you know, and Western civilization, all the rest of it. And you can have teachers who, I had a great teacher. His name was Larry Walker, and he was friends with Wayne Thiebaud, the famous artist. And Wayne Thiebaud spent a week workshop at where I went to school, and it was all wonderful. But you know, they would be the first to admit that they can only kind of suggest and things that will bring the artist out in you, you know, mm-hmm. and in the end, you've got to put in the time and, you know.
Yeah, I do want to say something on your comment earlier, Sarita, is the time, you and I have had this discussion, John and I have had this, time is so important. You don't get anything done quickly. You don't do anything good quickly. It's impossible. Mm. And, you know, there's that old saw, 10,000 hours. You need 10,000 hours before you consider yourself even an int. You know, an expert on something. I don't even think that's enough, honestly.
That's the minimum.
That's the minimum expert, you know, level. But without a lot of time. And the other thing is, too, we were listening to a podcast yesterday that Sarita sent me, and I got so angry at it because this guy was just full of it. You know, it was just like such garbage. He's like, oh, you know, being an entrepreneur is so easy. And, you know, you just have to open your eyes. And it's like, I'm an entrepreneur. I've had multiple companies, and it's not easy. Every day is hard. Every day is hard, and there's no guarantees, and there's always risk. With an artist, there's always risk that your time won't be appreciated. I believe that's correct. Mm-hmm. And that your art won't be appreciated, because it's not just about you releasing your feelings onto the canvas for you in particular. It's about other people seeing the vision too. And that has something to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and I think that's a really important, you know, element. When John was talking about he went to college, you know, and there were subjects that were important in terms of allowing you to be a well-rounded person and see what really is in the world, whether it's sports or, you know, exploratory. But I also see that kind of shifting when colleges became more of a pathway to a certain job that was going to grow certain industries. Mm-hmm. So that's a by design, capitalistic method, right?
Right.
And so that's, and I think life can be cyclical where art is appreciated and then it kind of falls off the bandwagon. Mm. And we see that in schools when they defund art programs and then they ramp back up to fund them. And I think we are.
Which is a crime, by the way. It's a crime.
It is a crime. And, yeah. But I'm noticing that people are pushing a lot of money into the arts right now because they are trying to identify maybe who's going to be the next commercial artists for propaganda. Because, you know, propaganda art is beautiful when you look at it.
You're inspired because of your visit to the propaganda museum recently.
Well, I can't stop looking at the propaganda museum because it reminds me of money and stamps. I mean, stamps are another form of art, not form of art. They are art.
Well, your point is well taken because, you know, their story of Riri Reifenstahl, you know, the Nazi propagandist. I mean, all her early films on that subject were beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like they were so well done, but in a very nefarious way. So it can be going both ways.
Well, and nefarious, just so we don't, you know, nefarious activity can happen anywhere. Right. Anywhere. But what I'm getting at is I don't think it's an accident that you get a bunch of artists together for a long period of time. You see who's got the discipline, who's got the creativity, and then you kind of choose that artist and they become the propaganda artist.
Yeah. Before you leave the subject, yeah. I wanted to say there's a guy, shout out to Bald and Bankrupt on YouTube, right now that we watch, and he travels around the Eastern Bloc countries looking for a Soviet-era mosaics. That was his thing. And he does it all over Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Russia, everything, to find these abandoned rail stations with these amazing propaganda, yes, scenes of farmers in the fields, but they're beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And they're true mosaics done by real artists who had been transferred into this kind of machine.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting to see because he covers all this stuff and they are beautiful. They are propaganda.
Well, okay, propaganda, let me just...
I want to hear John's comment on
it. Okay, well, I just want to make one point, and that is propaganda is a technique used to influence people. So going back to art, how influential art is in our lives for good and for bad and everything in between. So I just wanted to say, I play with that word a lot because it doesn't always have to be nefarious.
No, it's agenda driven, mm-hmm. basically. Go ahead, John.
Well, regarding propaganda, I mean, like you, I think you alluded to, there can be good and bad propaganda. And there was, I saw this piece on an artist, and this was before the current conflict in the Middle East, but this was, I think, might have been on 60 Minutes or one of those shows. And he did these huge photos of people, Palestinians and Israelis, and then he would paste them on some of the walls. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but and they were, I mean, they were like, you know, 20 feet high. And the whole point was, these are your fellow man, these are your neighbors, and they were just like, they weren't posed in anything. It was mostly just like a big Chuck Close painting of a face, you know, and it showed the human quality of these people, and it was having a very positive effect. And people enjoyed them. They came out. They looked at them. They stood around and talked to each other. You know, of course, that's all fallen by the wayside in this conflict we have in the Middle East now. But the whole idea of using art. I mean, now we have this whole advent of AI, which is an art form of in its own, and it's without doubt it's going to be used for a lot of good things. But also, there's that danger that it's going to fall into a lot of the wrong hands and be used in the wrong way. So, you know, the arts have always been. I mean, you can go back to somebody like Goya, who was a court painter. And was revered, by all of the benefactors of his time, and certainly the heads of the courts in Spain. And when Spain was involved in these terrible wars of that period, he came out with his pretty much as you could call him his anti-war art, where he showed these gruesome scenes. And of course, that was a form of propaganda. And because of his stature and because of his age, he was not condemned by the powers that be, which was, you know, unusual in any time, I suppose. But artists have generally, and you know, when we were talking earlier about different kinds of art, I mean, certainly there's art now that one would call social commentary type art. There's conceptual art. There's, you know, more traditional art, and there's a place for all of it. It's a big beautiful soup of a sort. A lot of people say they don't like conceptual art until I say, what did you think of Cristo? And remember, Cristo built the wall across Sonoma County. The running fences Yeah, he did a lot of wonderful things that I thought were just fabulous. So I mean, it's important to keep your mind open and try to see the value in certain things. And you're not, you know, it's not important to like everything, of course, but at least give it a chance before you say, okay, that's not for me, you know. So
I like the Goya example, because in Picasso, with his giant work that's in Bilbao,
Guernica
mm-hmm. is like,
there's a great story about that, by the way. You know, Picasso stayed in Paris, and you know, when the Nazis were there occupying it, and the Nazi hierarchy revered Picasso, and so these generals would come to his studio and look at his work and try to converse with him. His attitude was like, you know, I don't really want you here, but, you know, I guess he was gracious in his own way. And there was a postcard. He had done Gernika because that was about the Germans bombing the Basque country.
Yeah.
And there was a little poster or a postcard. And one of the Nazi generals came up and looked at it, and he picked it up and he said to Picasso, "Who did this?" And Picasso looked at him and said, "Why, you did."
Ooh. And he was a biting intellect,
yeah,
that guy.
Yeah. And so, you know, he had his own little way of fighting back, you know.
Yeah.
And his very presence of staying there during the occupation was a form of propaganda in a good way.
So, yeah. So that's propaganda used for good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Both. I never heard that story before.
Yeah.
It's a good
one.
Well,
and Picasso's a great example of his entire life was expressed through his art. You know, the ups, the downs, the, you know, maybe too much indulgence. And
I mean,
you just look at this and you actually see the man's life.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think, and that's the kind of artist he was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wanted to tell his story, you know, and people were more than willing to want to see it, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I want to shout out a good artist friend of mine, Edith Feidler, who is Eugene Feidler's widow, and they lived with Picasso in the Mediterranean for, I think, almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And on parting, the sun was in her eyes in her little convertible, and Picasso came over and wrapped a bandana around her head to kind of block the sun. And she said, "Thank you," and she never saw him again. And now that bandana's on her wall in the south of France, which I've seen, which is like, whoa.
There you go.
But he was a very interesting man, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, in terms of, like, where do you think the arts are, and where do you think they're going in terms of graphic art like you do in painting, for instance? Is it going the way it should, going in any one direction? Is it going in traditional directions? I mean, that's a broad question, broad stroke, but it seems to me like I've seen some really interesting art recently that I would never display in my house. Then again, it's not for me, right?
Right.
But also the large format seems to be really, really popular right now. And I think that's really aimed at the rich folk buying them because they've got big houses. They need big spaces, you know?
Yeah, it could be, but it also in museums, you know, because have big walls.
Right. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. There was a time in post-World War II era when American art became preeminent in the art, you know, it was in Paris for the first half of the 20th century, and then after World War II, it shifted to New York with the New York School and abstract art and people like, you know, Jackson Pollock and William de Kooning and Mark Rothko. I mean, I loved all of that stuff. I mean, it was so cutting edge and
the upstate guys like
and so American.
Wyeth,
you know?
Andrew Wyeth, and people.
Well,
like
Andrew
that.
Wyeth was on the other end of the spectrum. He was
true.
He was upholding a tradition that he had learned from his father, and then his son Jamie Wyeth is still alive, and he's still doing it. But but the art that became so, you know, and was hard, and it might have been the beginning of the American people as a whole not getting what the art world was about, you know, because the art, you know, it was messy and it was big and it was you know, it had a kind of rebellious nature built into it.
And mystery.
And, and you know, that went on for the 40s and 50s. And then in the 60s, they had a return to kind of imagery with, you know, the pop artists of people like Larry Rivers and Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg. And that went on for a while. And by the 70s, though, you know, by the late 60s, early 70s, we had, and this is when I was in college, art was two-dimensional art, painting, which I loved, was kind of running out of steam, and you had the advent of minimalism,
guys like Ellsworth Kelly and things like that.
Yeah, I really like Ellsworth Kelly and a lot of those, Agnes Martin, and I mean their work is, and it was very spiritual. It was,
yeah,
you know,
it is.
And then of course in California here, Richard Diebenkorn doing those big, huge Ocean Park pieces. That was, you know, that kind of picked up on that minimalist thing and then took it to, in my thinking, to another level. But there were painters who were, you know, just doing one big color on a canvas. And then there was, I'm trying to remember the painter who did just the white, they called the white paintings. I think
Mark Rothko?
No, Rothko always had, you know, like two or three colors. And but
Kelly did usually two colors.
Oh yeah. And we could have a whole conversation about minimalist art sometime. But what happened is painting got distilled down to such a level. There was no more imagery. There was no more line. It was just one color, and there was nowhere to go but back. You know, we'd run the cycle, so to speak, and it was nowhere to go to but bring something back into the space. Mm-hmm. And that, for me personally, that was when I discovered people like Wayne Thiebaud, who were doing these, you know, kind of humorous paintings, but they were beautifully done with lots of color and imagery and so forth. And so we entered the age of what was called pluralism in the New York, quote-unquote, art world, where anything goes. And so when you ask me, well, where is art going now? I think we're still in that phase of pluralism where it's whatever you know floats your boat as an artist.
Right.
Give it a try, mm-hmm. And that can be anything from traditional painting to sculpture to some form of social commentary work, some form of conceptual work, which, you know, for a lot of people is like, okay, I go to the museum and I see a pile of dirt in the corner and that's a piece of art. Well, you know.
Or a banana tape to a wall.
The famous banana tape to the wall. You know, quick story. I went into a hardware store after that aired on whatever, 60 Minutes, and they had, on the counter, they had a banana taped to the counter. And the guy, you know, I said, well, it's not art unless you tape it to the wall. And he just looked at me with this puzzled look, and I paid my bill and got out of there.
I wanted to comment, too. You know, there's the social commentary stuff in the 60s, 70s. You remember the artist and comic guy, Saul Steinberg?
Oh, of course, yeah.
I love Saul Steinberg. Yeah. It was like the reason before I was old enough to really read The New Yorker in a serious way.
Yeah.
I just peel through it for the Saul Steinbergs, you know.
Right.
And then we're always social commentary in a humorous fashion.
Right.
Always having to do with some man and his woman just having cocktails or something. Right. With pithy comments about fancy New York life kind of thing.
Right,
but it was
right.
Pretty cool because it was art too.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, yeah, the cartoons in The New Yorker are a form of art.
Oh, yeah,
for
sure. And
social commentary for sure.
What are you going to say? Sorry?
Yeah, they're expressions, again, of humans. And and to limit art into these categories is actually another crime. I mean, women or men who sew, who knit, who crochet, I mean, these are all patterns and colors, and it's still a form of expression.
Yeah.
And so I do think we are in this time right now where whatever your avenue is something that you should pursue. And if it doesn't work, then go on and try something else. You know, play the piano for a little while. Mm-hmm. But, you know, art is so expansive, and it is what makes humans resilient. It makes us creative. It binds us together in more of a unity way than divisive way.
Yeah.
It's something you can pass on to your son, for instance.
Of course. But I would agree totally with what you said, because art, I heard it, I was in a conversation with some people, and that one guy said, well, art's just a commodity. Ooh. Like any other commodity. And and for some people it is. I mean, if you're trying to run a gallery and you got to pay the light bills and so forth, you probably start seeing it that way. But I was quick to, you know, interject that, you know, no, it's what makes us human. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what sets us apart from the animal kingdom. We feel. Mm-hmm. We feel things when we hear a piece of music. We feel things when we hear a good piece of poetry or look at a good painting. We feel things when we get up and dance, you mm-hmm. know. or read a book, you know, a good, or watch a play or a movie. So, yeah, art is what makes us human, and I think it can make us much more human. That's, you know, if we all engage, and there's plenty of places to plug in for everybody, you know. So, anyway.
Well, and I think that is so important. You know, we still are human, and so the less human we become, the more space we allow for things that are artificial to take over. Yeah. And we are in this space right now where, you know, to recognize that it's man-machine again. This isn't the first time in history it's happened.
It's been going on for a while.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, I would like to invite John back to have another conversation later in the month, maybe about AI and the implications there, because it's really kind of taking on some new new steam in a bad way this past month, I've noticed. But do you have anything else you'd like to ask John, Sarita?
Well, please come back. And yes, AI is a completely different
subject
because it does take up a lot of space. But John, I just want to say, you know, you are a living example of a whole human being. And I am just so honored to meet you and, you know, to see somebody who's living a human life through art.
Well, thank you. I really do appreciate that. And it's been great being here. I think let's continue the conversation.
Yeah. Okay. And if you have anybody in the audience, if you have any questions for John or about art or anything like that, please contact us at Latham, that's LATHAM, at Madmana Studios, MADMANA Studios.com. We'll definitely respond to you and respond or comment on this podcast. If you'd like to hear more of this kind of thing, tune back into Madmana Studios and Sarita in the Stream and all of our other podcasts. John McCormick, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And great comments. And Sarita, as always, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Latham.
Thanks, Sarita. Bye-bye. Thank you for being with us today here on Focus on Art. If you like this kind of content, please like and subscribe. The algorithm really, really likes that. So do we. Until next week, John McCormick, Sarita Patel, and Latham Woodward say thank you for listening. We greatly appreciate your time. For more information or questions, you can email us at latham@madmanastudios.com. That's LATHAM at Madmana, MADMANA studios.com. All thoughts and comments are appreciated.